Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Governor Kathy Hochul wants to end contracts that let ICE use county jails, but her proposal leaves out other forms of cooperation with immigrant authorities untouched. What would change, what wouldn't, and why it matters, coming up. In Pennsylvania, Governor Shapiro delivers his budget this morning. Rising costs, energy demand, and election year politics are all in play. We'll explain what to watch. We'll talk with the River Reporter's Leah Mayo about what's driving housing affordability costs up on both sides of the Upper Delaware. And for years, Pike County residents have had to travel out of county for basic medical care. But a new primary and immediate care center is opening in Dingman's Ferry. Kimberly Izar has the story. And what do Bach, Dizzy Gillespie, and Led Zeppelin all have in common? We'll find out later, after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Republican-led House is on track to vote today on a spending package to end the partial government shutdown. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports it limits funding for the Department of Homeland Security.
The Departments of Defense, Transportation, and Health and Human Services and more would be funded through September. But the Department of Homeland Security would get just 2 weeks of funding so lawmakers can negotiate new immigration law enforcement reforms. Top House Appropriations Democrat Rosa DeLauro told the House Rules Committee that's why she's a yes.
Did we get everything we wanted? Hell no. Did the Republicans get everything they wanted? Hell no.
But not all House Democrats are on the same page. Many argue DHS should be reformed now. The Senate approved the bipartisan plan last week following a rare deal between Senate Democrats and the Trump White House. House Republicans are expected to support President Trump's call to vote yes. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
President Trump says Republicans should take away control of elections from at least 15 states. He didn't say which ones. Voting is plainly specified in Article 1 of the Constitution as a right belonging to the states. But Trump spoke yesterday in a podcast with former FBI Deputy Director Dan Bongino.
The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting. And we have states that are so crooked, and they're counting votes. We have states that I won that show I didn't win. Now, you're going to see something in Georgia where they were able to get with a court order the ballots. You're going to see some interesting things come out.
Last week, FBI agents raided an elections office near Atlanta, Georgia. They seized hundreds of boxes with ballots inside them from the 2020 presidential election. Trump claims he won that national election. He didn't. He claims he won the state of Georgia in 2020. He didn't. Georgia officials say they don't know where those ballots are now. Stocks open mixed this morning as Pepsi announced plans to cut prices of popular snack foods. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 2 points in early trading.
Pepsi has heard from shoppers fed up with high grocery prices, some of whom are switching to cheaper store brand products. Pepsi sold fewer bags of Doritos, Cheetos, and Lay's potato chips in its most recent quarter. The company's planning to cut prices by up to 15% to regain market share. Prices of corn chips and guacamole were already falling ahead of this weekend's Super Bowl. Disney has tapped the head of its theme park division to be its next CEO. Josh D'Amaro will take over for Bob Iger at the company's annual meeting next month. Speaking of job changes, the Labor Department was supposed to issue a monthly report on turnover in the job market this morning, but that's been postponed by the government shutdown. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 7 points. The Nasdaq is down more than 200. This is NPR. A federal judge is blocking the Trump administration from ending temporary protections for more than 300,000 Haitians in the U.S. Those TPS protections were scheduled to end today. Faith leaders from across Ohio have gathered in Springfield to show support to Haitian immigrants. From member station WYSO, Catherine Mobley reports.
More than 1,000 people crowded into the St. John Missionary Baptist Church for Here We Stand, a faith-led rally. Reverend Kristen Ufel White is a bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Southern Ohio. She fears ending TPS will devastate Springfield.
It will remove the neighbors we depend on. It will hurt local schools and businesses. And yes, it will hurt churches. It will hurt us being who we are called to be.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says he's gotten mixed signals on if ICE agents will step up deportation efforts in the state. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Mobley.
President Trump and Colombian President Gustavo Petro meet at the White House today. They have heavily criticized each other. Trump has suggested Petro could be taken to the U.S., like former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Trump and Petro's tension has since eased a little. Musician and talk show host Kelly Clarkson says she is stepping away from her daily show. She says she's making the decision in order to prioritize her children. But Clarkson says she will continue to write music and perform. She says she will also appear occasionally on the show The Voice. Clarkson's show is now in its seventh season. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Now, a little bit more on a story we told you about yesterday and a significant shift. Governor Kathy Hochul is proposing a new bill that would curb cooperation between local governments and federal immigration authorities, but it stops short of the broader protection sought by immigrant advocates. The measure would ban contracts that allow ICE to detain immigrants in county jails while leaving more informal collaboration between local law enforcement and federal agents in place. Supporters say it's a meaningful step toward keeping local police focused on local public safety. Critics argue it doesn't go far enough. I spoke with Liv Veazey, reporter with New York Focus, who's been covering the surprise proposal and its political impacts.
It's a surprise because Hochul has never backed a couple big sanctuary bills that have been proposed in the legislature before. She's never vocally backed them. They've never reached her desk for her to sign them. But just earlier in January, she was asked in an interview whether or not she supported those bills. And she very clearly stated she didn't support them. And she added that the legislation that we currently have in New York is working, is what she said. So she seemed to imply in that interview that she was not interested in making changes to sanctuary legislation. Just a few weeks later, last Friday, she then came out with her Local Cops, Local Crimes Act, which seemed, because she spoke about the presence of ICE in Minneapolis, and she spoke about the killings of Renee Nicole Good and Alex Preddy, very clearly in response to what's unfolding in Minneapolis at the moment and what's unfolding in other cities across the country.
The preferred legislation that immigrants' rights advocates are looking for her to endorse is the New York for All Act. I want to ask you a little bit more about that later, but first I want to just give folks an idea of what are New York's current rules around collaborating with ICE?
Sure. So right now, New York has a kind of piecemeal collection of executive orders, state Supreme Court decisions, and laws that provide some sanctuary protections, but no comprehensive law. So the most important kind of piece of that, of the existing sanctuary protections is a 2017 executive order originally by Cuomo that Hochul signed again to preserve during her tenure. And that order bans collaboration between state employees, including police, so state troopers, and federal immigration officers. But there's a sort of crucial caveat in that executive order that state police can collaborate with ICE if somebody has been suspected of a crime. And lawyers, legal experts say that it's really unclear exactly how that's put into practice and just how much leeway state police have to be able to collaborate with ICE in situations where there is a crime involved or an alleged crime. On top of that, there is a 2018 state Supreme Court ruling that says that both county and state police, so any law enforcement in the state, cannot honor ICE detainers, which just means they can't take somebody into custody only based on the accusation of that person having committed a civil violation, which is what most immigration violations are. They're civil rather than criminal. So, for instance, if a county jail has somebody in their detention already, they can't hold that person for longer just because ICE has told them they have a civil violation.
Talk a little bit about Nassau County on Long Island and the intersection of their county executive and the reelection campaign for Hochul and the county executive's own gubernatorial ambitions.
Sure. So Nassau County is one of the counties with their county executive, Bruce Blakeman, has been the most vocal about his support for collaborating with ICE. They have multiple contracts with ICE that allow them to put their local, their county and city level police officers in the service of immigration enforcement. And they have detained some 3,000 people last year for ICE. Bruce Blakeman is running against Kathy Hochul in the upcoming gubernatorial race. And it's possible that, you know, when after Hochul announced this, she then, her campaign then released an attack ad against Blakeman, using, in his own language, describing him as all in on ICE.
Yeah, so she announced the local cops, local crimes bill the same day Blakeman launched a campaign to challenge Hochul in the election. So how would Hochul's proposal change the status quo with this bill?
So there are two important things that this proposal adds. She's proposing to ban what are called 287G contracts, which are contracts between county or city level police and ICE that allow ICE to deputize local law enforcement. So that could look like anything from a sheriff's office relaying information to ICE when they come across somebody they suspect of being undocumented, to local police officers actually being vested with a lot of the authority that a full-on ICE agent has. So they could arrest somebody without a warrant just because they suspect them of the civil violation of an immigration, violation. The other important contract, the type of contract that she proposed banning, are called intergovernmental service agreements. Those are just contracts that allow ICE to rent out local jail cells. So like in county jails, ICE then pays the county a per diem. So a certain amount of money per person per day. And those contracts bring in, collectively across the state, millions of dollars for local law enforcement.
In her press conference on Friday, she also said she would enshrine, quote, sensitive locations, that's schools, houses of worship, hospitals, homes, as places where federal immigration enforcement cannot enter to perform an arrest without a judicial warrant. She also mentioned the idea of adding a stipulation to public safety grants from the state that would prohibit counties from using grant money to work with ICE, basically, but the localities could still use their own resources to cooperate with ICE. It does feel like it's a portion of what folks are looking for, specifically the New York for All Act. That's more comprehensive. Hochul's bill is a more limited approach. Tell folks a little bit more about the preferred legislation that immigrant rights movement folks are asking for.
Sure. And I'll just add those other proposals you mentioned. She has already mentioned those in her State of the State address. And what immigrant advocates often say about those, especially the sensitive locations, is that it's sort of just giving people permission to exercise a right that they already have.
Right.
So that doesn't actually expand on people's rights. Already a hospital has the right to ask for a judicial warrant from ICE. But in terms of New York for All, I guess in general, what New York for All tries to address that Hochul's proposal doesn't address are the many ways in which police departments and sheriff's offices collaborate with ICE all the time on an informal basis. So even with no 287G contract, with nothing in ink, there's a lot of informal collaboration. So we hear anecdotally from immigrant advocates all the time about this collaboration, but we spoke to the police chief of Allegheny Village, who told us who had just recently, his department had just recently signed a 287G agreement. And he told us that the cancellation of that contract would change literally nothing about the ways that they collaborate with ICE. So some of those things, some of that collaboration, they'll offer perimeters if ICE is going to somebody's door to try to perform a house arrest, or if they have arrested detained people, but they don't have the cars for it. He said that his department would provide transportation, and that's hours of, you know, manpower in the service of just civil immigration enforcement. And so all of those things he can continue doing, and he said he would continue doing, even without the contract, even if the contract is banned. And those are the types of collaboration that New York for All would ban.
The village of Allegheny in Cattaraugus County in western New York, there along the border of Pennsylvania. What did Hochul say about New York for All? What has she been saying about New York for All?
So earlier in an interview earlier, she seemed to make the claim that she was concerned that New York for All would impede local police's abilities to investigate crime, and that therefore it would make cities and counties less safe. Immigrant advocates say that actually the reverse is true, that when everybody feels that they can go to the police and not be turned into ICE, that actually localities become much safer. In her press conference, when she announced these new proposals, she did seem to take a bit of a softer approach on New York for All and said something more along the lines of, you know, things have changed because of Minneapolis. And when something comes across my desk, then I'll make a decision on it. But she sort of demurred from, you know, saying one way or the other whether or not she was for it. So she seems to have potentially shifted her position slightly.
And what are lawmakers saying about her proposals?
So lawmakers like Senator Andrew Gunardis, who is the sponsor behind New York for All, I think saying that, you know, they appreciate her attention towards the importance of passing sanctuary legislation, but that it's just not quite enough, because really the important, some of the most important collaboration that happens is this informal stuff that wouldn't be touched really in her proposal.
Liv Veazey, she covers immigration for New York Focus. You can read about her latest reporting about Governor Hochul's proposal on banning ICE collaboration contracts at nysfocus.com. Liv, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim.
And we'll have more about this story with reaction from a local advocacy organization in upstate New York for the many who are not happy with this proposal. That's tomorrow on Radio Chatskill. And then later today on Radio Catskill, we'll be bringing you Governor Josh Shapiro's live address to the Pennsylvania legislature as he lays out his budget priorities to state lawmakers. That's right after Radio Chatskill this morning. But as in a preview, Jason Dole spoke with Spotlight PA reporter Kate Huangpo to find out what to expect in the speech.
We only just resolved last year's budget about 4 months ago. So I think a lot of what we're keeping our eye on is all the things that were kind of unfinished from that budget. So things like transit funding or taxing skill games, legalizing cannabis. These are all things that Shapiro's asked for, you know, quite a few times now, and we have not been able to get any of those things over the finish line in our legislature. So I guess we're seeing if anything's going to change.
Last year's budget was so late. I think there's got to be interest in seeing whether they can avoid taking that long this year. I mean, everybody's got to be thinking of that today as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely the question. I think, you know, this year is an election year, or at least our governor's up for re-election. Like, there's a little bit more public pressure or eyes on the legislature this year. That tends to be associated with a somewhat quicker budget process. I also think, you know, people are not fully recovered from last year's budget process. You know, it, again, ended like 4 months ago. And so I think everyone's hoping that it'll be a smoother ride this time around.
Could you give us a broad outline of what happens after the governor gives this budget address? What does this mean for the legislative and budgeting process in Pennsylvania, and what are the next steps?
The governor is basically going to propose a spending plan. After that, lawmakers, state legislators will hold budget hearings for each of the departments within the state. So, you know, Department of Education, Department of State, Department of Environmental Protection. The Senate and House Appropriations Committees are going to hold hearings for them to sort of question, like, do you really need this much money? Do you, what about this program or that program or whatever it is? And then come May or June, proper negotiations sort of start where legislative leaders are sort of talking on a day-to-day basis with the governor's team, and they're trying to work out a final deal. Our deadline is June 30th, but we usually don't hit that date. So sometimes it's a few days over, sometimes it's a few weeks over. In last year's case, it was a few months over. So we'll see what this year looks like.
Jason Dole speaking with Spotlight PA reporter Kate Huangpo about what to expect in the speech of Governor Shapiro's budget address that's live from Harrisburg, his 2026-2027 budget address. You can hear that right after Radio Chatskill here on Radio Catskill, and more from Kate as well and others. We'll take a break, and when we come back, one of the things that the governor is expected to address in his speech is rising housing costs, but the housing crunch doesn't stop at the state line. After the break, we'll look at what New York and Pennsylvania have in common when it comes to housing and what that means locally. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
With dangerously cold temperatures in the forecast, warming centers are open across our region to provide a safe, heated place for anyone who needs it. Locations are available at Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, as well as Pike County in Pennsylvania. If you or someone you know needs a warm place to go, you can find a full list of locations and hours at wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, physician and healthcare policymaker Zeke Emanuel.
A lot of the wellness gurus out there, they make things way too complicated.
So how does Emanuel see wellness?
It should be something that you actually enjoy.
The wellness industry is gigantic and mostly wrong. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Housing affordability is becoming harder to ignore across our region from both sides of the Upper Delaware River. It's a challenge touching working families, seniors, and young people who want to stay rooted in the communities they call home. The River Reporter's Liam Mayo joins us now to explain how delays in funding, rising costs, and local zoning decisions are shaping what housing can or can't get built in both New York and Pennsylvania. Hi, Liam.
Hi, Tim.
So we mentioned that Governor Shapiro is making his budget address to the legislature later this morning. And again, you can hear that live here. But talk a little bit more about housing reform and the obstacles that Governor Shapiro faces there, because that's something he's expected to address in the speech.
Yeah. So Spotlight PA, you were just talking with, had an article out outlining some of the state level conversations that are being had around housing affordability, and some of the barriers to that. Some of the things that they identified as standing out from those conversations are local zoning control and the need for programs to help people stay in their homes. Essentially, housing advocates are saying that a lot of the way local zoning laws are written stifles the potential for creating new housing, and specifically the new housing that would really help address the affordability crisis. Whereas local municipalities are saying, hey, there's a reason why we have local control. It's because we know our zoning decisions best. And then on the other point, they're saying like funding for home repairs is something that is necessary so that people can, if they're in a home, stay in their home and, you know, not be displaced and need or be one of those people needing a new unit. There was a conversation in Wayne County, to bring it sort of more local, a couple of months ago, organized by this group called Wayne Voices, bringing together housing advocates or people working in that space across both Wayne and Pike counties, county leaders. And they identified some of the same issues happening locally in Wayne and Pike as were being discussed at that national or that statewide level. They mentioned on the zoning control issue that there's little the county can do on its own. Like, if county leaders might be in agreement that there needs to be more housing and this is a crisis and we need to do something about it, but at the end of the day, it's a local borough council or it's a local board of supervisors who's going to make the decision about what individual zoning laws can allow and what projects can ultimately get approved. So there's very little the county can do on its own to get a specific project approved or not approved. Another element to that that county leaders brought up was the fact that there are very few places where you can build a major housing development, specifically in like rural areas like Wayne and Pike. They mentioned that federal funding rules require a major housing project to be built in a place that has central water and sewer, so connected into that system rather than having its own sort of septic field. And there are very few places in Wayne County specifically where that is available, specifically really only Hawley, Honesdale, and Waymart. And there are major housing projects kind of being proposed in all of those places, but then that goes back to the local control, and that goes back to the local leaders in those places really need to be on board with the notion that more housing is needed to allow those projects to go through. And I've been going on for a while, but the other thing that they mentioned about the like funding for home repairs and the housing refurbishments, a couple of people who spoke have been working in the space for a very long time, and they've seen the way these projects or these programs have evolved over the years, specifically like programs from the federal level funding like home renovations for people repairs that allow people to stay in their homes. And what these people said was over the years, the amount of funding available for those projects has dried up a little bit at the state level and at the federal level. And at the same time, the federal government has imposed more and more restrictions on like what needs to be done, making those projects more and more expensive. And those are, to be clear, good restrictions like, oh, you need to take the asbestos out of the walls. Oh, you need to, you know, remove the lead paint. So the restrictions by themselves aren't like bad, but combined with the fact that there's less funding available, combined with the fact that those restrictions make it more expensive to make those projects happen, overall, it means that there's just much less ability to get anything done in the space of making people's homes safe to live in addition to it being really hard to create new funding or new housing.
The Wayne Voices group, which is comprised of Wayne County leaders, it's a nonpartisan group, it sounds like they're all on the same page. I mean, I think when you talk about housing and housing shortages in the area, people say, well, why aren't they building? Why don't they want to build? It sounds like they do, but they're frustrated by the process.
Yeah. The officials specifically said, like, to the people in attendance who, you know, people showed up to this public meeting because they were themselves, like citizens of the county, frustrated with the inability to create more housing. And what county leaders encouraged was the, for people to show up at meetings where housing is being discussed. Wayne County Commissioner Jocelyn Kramer said, quote, if your township supervisors, borough council people aren't hearing there's a need, they can't support or help that. So I think oftentimes when there are, and this isn't, you know, Wayne County specific, Pennsylvania specific, this is nationwide, oftentimes when there are big planning conversations or conversations at planning board meetings about major development projects of any kind, and housing development specifically, the conversation can get dominated by the people who already live there, who are, you know, concerned, rightly or wrongly, about the impact new construction will have on, you know, their existing properties and their, you know, the value of what they have, the change that a new development will bring to the area. So county leaders were encouraging, like, if you want housing and if you want these things to be built, you should show up at those meetings and sort of be a counterbalancing voice saying and evidencing the need for housing and the need for that kind of development.
Well, speaking of need, Heather Misler, the administrative officer with Wayne County's housing department, flat out called it a housing crisis, saying, quote, Pennsylvania, Wayne County, nationwide, I don't think enough people understand the gravity of the situation and we need to work together. What is she saying the need is there in Wayne County for housing?
Yeah, Wayne County did a housing study a couple of years ago to identify the need and to be one of those things that, you know, county leaders can point to say, like, hey, we're not just saying that you need to build more housing. There's, you know, it's proven that there needs to be more housing. Kind of a key figure that Wayne County leaders will quote from that study is a projection that by 2030, Wayne County will need an additional 1,528 units of housing just to sustain its current population. And that sounds like a reasonable number, like, you know, especially when you're talking policy and governance, anything under like 100,000 feels like you can understand it. But you need to build those units kind of one at a time or in small chunks. There are current housing projects under discussion in Waymart, in Honesdale, but those are, you know, 40-ish units. And there was a mention of a housing project in Waymart that took like 16 months or so to really work through the process. So like 1,500 units by 2030 feels reasonable, but you need to have a clear runway for those projects to happen to do anything close to be able to meet that need.
And she's talking about the cycle of housing as well, creating multiple types of housing, helping the entire spectrum of people in need. For example, that low-income units would free up units that could be attainable for middle-income residents of the county. So there's a lot going on there, but I want to make sure we get some reporting that you have also in New York out here as well. Sullivan County officials say they likely won't get another chance at state funding of that Gateway housing project until 2027. Let's remind folks about this Gateway housing project and why they're saying there's going to be a delay.
Yeah, so the Gateway housing project is something county leaders were talking about throughout 2025. As you know, discussed in 2025, it would be a 20-bed, you know, homeless shelter proposed for several different locations throughout the county, in Thompson or in Liberty. And it would be funded by a state grant program, the Homeless Housing and Assistance Program offered by the New York State Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, to the tune for that project of around $8 million. The project failed to secure legislative approval in 2025. It needs to get a supermajority of the legislators on board to be able to get funding from that program. And the county, sort of heading into 2026, is looking at another location in the village of Monticello, and is sort of has identified a specific piece of property that it's looking at. But we talked with County Manager Josh Potosik sort of mid-January about the timeline for that, and he said that it's unlikely that the new designs for this project would be ready by summer, even though, you know, they designed a project in 2025. You can't kind of just like copy and paste the same things into a new location. So the county needs to come up with new designs for this new place. It needs to negotiate with the owners of the property to actually, you know, be able to build it on that property or to be able to own that property, it needs to theoretically incorporate some of the comments from legislators made during the 2025 project, where legislators were saying, like, is this the right size for the project? Do we want to house other things here? Is this the right cost for this project to get it approved? And then after all of that, you still need to sort of go back to the legislature and get legislative approval for this. So he was saying it's kind of unlikely that all of that would be able to happen by the summer. And the summer is when this grant program opens. The HHAP grant in 2025 began accepting applications on June 12. It closes applications once no more funds are available, and last year it closed applications on September 16. So if this project isn't sort of ready to go to grant by that time, there's sort of a high chance that it would miss that window, and then the next time it could even be like considered through this avenue would be the summer of 2027.
And Potosik also told you that it, at last time he checked, that there's a majority of legislators that prefer to have this this facility in the village of Monticello or just outside the village of Monticello, showing again there's a support for this at that level. But again, it sounds like Sullivan County, Wayne County, the same sorts of things are happening. These process questions, these barriers when it comes to planning zoning. Is that a through line that you're seeing on both sides of the river?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same story in Sullivan as it is in Wayne, where county leaders can, you know, understand the need for housing and understand on a general level that housing needs to be addressed. But the county doesn't by itself have like local zoning control or authority. You know, a project doesn't get built in Sullivan County. It gets built in Thompson. It gets built in Liberty. It gets built in a particular location. When the original location was brought up for public hearing, there was a lot of opposition from residents of Thompson who sort of yelled at the public hearing, would you want to have this in your backyard? Mm-hmm. And various, you know, members of the county pushed back. We had Health and Human Services Commissioner John Little say this quote about sort of the progress at going for a housing shelter, not just over the past year, but over decades of the county knowing that this is a need. He said, quote, "We have reviewed many sites over the years, and while nearly everyone agrees that a shelter is needed, far fewer are willing to welcome one near their homes. This tension has kept progress out of reach for decades. Many have tried, but no one has come as far as we have today." So, yeah, so that that tension is, I think, you know, evidenced across the country, across New York and Pennsylvania, and evidenced in our local area as being a major barrier to creating housing, mm-hmm. and to meeting that need that I think we all are on some level aware is there in our communities.
That's Liam Mayo, news editor for the River Reporter. You can read his reporting at riverreporter.com and all of the great reporting from the team there. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
After a break, we'll turn to Pike County. They've long been considered a healthcare desert, but that may be changing. Northwell Health is opening a new primary and immediate care center in Dingman's Ferry. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar toured the facility and spoke with one of the doctors bringing care closer to home. That's coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
Today's science is on the threshold of a new era.
On the next Radiolab, we go on a quest to find
the essence of life.
Life.
The key we've been looking for.
Where you'd least expect it.
LSD.
Yeah, let's get the party going.
The Age of Aquaticus on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, a Japanese big band does the mambo. We'll hear new exotic sounds by vibraphonist Carolyn Trowbridge and a band called Sometimes We Only Worry. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pike County has long been considered a health desert as the only county in the state of Pennsylvania without a hospital or urgent care facility. Northwell Health hopes to close the healthcare gap for residents. The largest healthcare system in New York is expanding into Pennsylvania, starting with a primary care and immediate care center in Dingman's Ferry. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar visited the new facility for a tour and spoke with Dr. Michael Mandarano, primary care physician at Northwell Health.
So we are in the corridor of patient care area at the Dingman's Ferry site at Northwell Health in Pike County, Pennsylvania.
So how many examination rooms are there here?
We have 4 examination rooms here. So this is a typical examination room. Obviously, we have a scale to weigh patients, our ear and eye station, an exam table, a computer screen to access patient records. We have an EKG machine here in this particular room at the time, and then all the tools of the trade, tongue depressors, gauze, and then we have a cabinet here with some more stuff here.
Awesome.
And obviously, we have gloves too.
The Northwell Health Dingman's Ferry location opened about
January 5th. Well, we chose Dingman's Ferry because there's a longstanding gap in access to care in this particular area. And because of that, there has been a delay in treatment in patients. So it's important for Northwell to bring that care to the Dingman's Ferry site. We're going to bring a fresh and unique healthcare experience to Pennsylvania, one that's based on community-based care, local decision-making, and a strong clinical integration.
That's beautiful. And I know a lot of people are very excited about Northwell Health coming to Pike County. I mean, Pike County is the only county in the state that doesn't have a urgent care center or a hospital. So it's especially timely.
Yes, it certainly is. You know, this facility is the first step in a broader vision of what we plan to do in Pike County. And our long-term commitment, it's a starting point, but it's not the ending point. It's about building a web of care.
Tell me a little bit about some of the services that you guys provide.
So at this particular site, we provide primary care for all ages, newborns right up to elderly. We also provide preventative care, chronic condition management, and non-urgent medical needs, immediate care.
Immediate care is different than urgent care. Can you kind of describe what, or is it the same?
It's very similar. There are some things that are more urgent that we are not able to do here, but everything from strains, sprains, colds, acute asthma attacks, bee stings, things like that.
What has the community feedback been so far? How has the community responded?
It's been great. Our schedule has been filling up nicely. We have things here that patients have liked. We have an x-ray machine, for instance, and we can interpret x-rays for things like URIs. Patients come in with concerns of that they have a pneumonia, things like that. Just the other day, we also saw a gentleman who injured his toes while trying to clean his shoes, and he did have a fracture. So we were able to provide that in real time.
You know, I imagine that obviously opening a new healthcare center, it takes a little bit of time to find the right crew. Have there been some challenges that you're kind of working through?
You know, honestly, things have gone pretty smoothly. I'm really happy with that. Obviously, there's a little bit that we have to tweak on our own, but overall, structurally, I think we're there.
Dr. Mandarano, I know that you have been a physician for several decades now.
It's hard to believe.
And in Pennsylvania, tell me a little bit about what makes this region so special.
So having grown up in northeastern Pennsylvania, namely Scranton, and this being not too far, it's a beautiful area. So it kind of ties that together. It's rural medicine, which is exciting because I've never practiced rural medicine before. So excited to do that. And it's a connectedness with the community and kind of goes along with what we're trying to do with community-based care. This area has a lot of veterans. So that's a very special thing for me. because I know the importance and the sacrifice that both veterans and families have made so that I can safely have gone to medical school and get my training. So I appreciate that. Additionally, it's important because from this area and to have the strong arm of Northwell with its clinical integration, to bring that to patients in this rural area is really exciting.
As we were talking about a little bit earlier, the county has had to rely on other counties or other states to provide healthcare, New Jersey or New York, for example. Now there's an increasing number of healthcare providers, including Northwell here. How are you thinking about working with other healthcare providers, or kind of what does that system look like?
Yeah, so we're going to have to rely on other health networks and systems and partner with them to provide the best care we can for patients in this region.
Do you want to walk me through the rest of the space?
Sure.
Okay. So what else have we got?
So we have another area for a medical assistant to sit and do some computer work. We have some equipment storage here, our housekeeping unit. Don't forget the fire extinguisher.
Very necessary.
Very necessary. We also have an area where we have x-rays to be performed.
Okay.
Yeah, so at our x-ray facility here, what we do is we do a preliminary read, and then it's also linked with our Northwell radiologist to get the final read. And now entering a point-of-care testing where we are going to have our vaccines, and we can do some immediate tests like, you know, rapid strep, flu. We're going to do some blood draws here.
How many folks have you seen so far? Do you have a sense?
Approximately 100 patients.
Okay. Have quite a bit of that been related to cold, flu season?
Yeah, we've seen obviously quite a bit of respiratory illnesses, but there have been some other things that we've seen. Again, for instance, the other day we talked about the fracture that we've seen. So, yeah, there's a variety of things, and we're seeing all age groups from young right up to the older patients.
Yeah.
We are in the thick of our winter months. So before we left, Dr. Mondorano gave his tried and true tips for what to do in case of frostbite or hypothermia.
Obviously, if they're having signs of frostbite, you know, in their fingers or toes, we recommend that they go indoors, keep warm. Don't put your hands under hot water. Resist that treatment. It really should be warm. Have someone check that if you need to. If that doesn't work, if you see blisters, please go to the emergency department. And then in terms of chest pain, if someone's experiencing chest pain or short of breath or fatigue or confusion, I would seek immediate medical care for that.
And what to look out for while shoveling?
Shoveling snow is really like lifting weights, and it can really take a toll on you. And obviously, you can have a heart attack or injure some other parts of your body, so like low back. So we recommend that, again, either you pay someone or push it around or use equipment if you can, which brings up another thing like snow blowers. Obviously, be careful with snow blowers. Don't stick your hand in them or anything like that.
And what are some of, you know, the health cautionary things that people should be looking out for when they are in the snow or when they are in the cold?
Yeah, again, so obviously frostbite, bundle up, be cognizant of that. And then should you develop chest pain in men, it's a little different than in women. If you develop chest pain, it's going to be, you know, we call it the Levine sign, where they put their hand on top of their chest. If they're short of breath, if they're dizzy, if they just don't feel right, just get checked out. That's the most important thing. In women, it could present a little differently. They don't always have those classic signs. Mm-hmm. So again, if you're unsure, just get checked.
Doctor, as you think about kind of the future of what this location could look like, serving this community, what are you most excited about?
I'm most excited about the people in the community, and bringing, again, community-based care to patients and integrating that with a larger network. And also, you know, patients with some unique illnesses where we have specialists in New York, hopefully they won't need to travel as far to get that care.
And thanks, Kimberly Izar, for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, from Baroque to blues to classical rock, a cello like you've never heard it before. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Colombian actresses Catalina Sandino Moreno, Sasha Calle, and Lina Esco star in the new crime thriller from Netflix, The Rip, alongside some of Hollywood's biggest names.
Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, Joe Carnahan. I mean, like, it's such a great group of people.
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now a journey through musical history on a cello. Alex Prisgentis brings us Bach to Blues to Jazz, a program that moves from the Baroque compositions of J.S. Bach to the swinging sounds of Dizzy Gillespie and Dave Brubeck, and even touches on rock and blues classics from The Animals to Led Zeppelin. He'll be performing at the Mamikating Public Library tonight at 5, and Alex joins us now. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Now, we've talked to you before about your classical training, but you're never bound by tradition, Alex. You use pedals and looping stations and amplification to transform your cello into this modern wall of sound instrument. And you've even described your work as Uber Arts, delivering food for the soul. What does that phrase mean to you?
So we developed the phrase Uber Arts through a specific aspect of these cello shows, as we like to call them. You know, we don't ever turn them concerts. Sometimes the term concert may denote an aspect where a performer is almost removed from the intimacy of one's audience. In developing a cello show, I really like to create an atmosphere that's very intimate. And in doing that, we bridge the gap between history and harmony. So if any of the listeners today have attended one of my shows in the past across Sullivan County, you'll know that in addition to the different compositions that are augmented at times with guitar pedals and a looping station that have been described, there's also historical narrations that showcase some of the hidden stories behind the melodies and the melody makers. So in that term, Uber Arts, I'd like to say delivering food for the soul, we really enjoy developing an experience that's not simply the music, or in this case, some of the augmented and somewhat avant-garde music that some might describe, but it's really an intimate experience that bridges the gap between history and melody, that provides an all-inclusive, immersive time for our audiences.
And your newest program, Bach to Blues to Jazz, is today at 5 at the Mamikating Library. And you've said Bach was, in many ways, the original jazz artist. What do you hear in Bach that makes that connection so clear for you?
So, you know, it's interesting. One of the best places to see this in Bach is his 6 cello suites, which is what we almost begin the program with. In these 6 cello suites, they were written between about 1717 and 1723. For some context, this is when Benjamin Franklin was a teenager. The cello suites use a great deal of different, as you might say, chord progressions and runs that can be very well adapted to jazz selections. The one in particular we feature is the prelude from his suite number 2 in D minor. It's a bit different from the other Bach preludes, which have a bit more of a structured composition. The D minor prelude can really be open to a wide range of interpretations in tempos, in ornamental stylings, and it constructs itself so well that in particular with the prelude from D minor, you're able to use parts of it in actual jazz compositions. And if anyone's able to attend tonight, you will hear that. Sometimes I will incorporate parts of Bach preludes, such as the prelude of the suite in D minor, in pieces by Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and others.
Well, you know, with all these different artists, and when you're putting a program like this together, what's the through line you're kind of listening for?
What's the through line I'm listening for? Well, in each of these selections that I feature, whether, again, it be Gillespie, Miles Davis, or even some of the rock selections you mentioned, such as from Led Zeppelin and The Animals, there is more or less a steady chord progression, which lays the foundation for the selection. And typically one run-through or two of the phrase will just be over those chords. And then you're able to essentially, some might say, dance around with facility on the cello, revolving around those chords, so creating certain scale runs or dancing through arpeggiated melodies, or in sometimes what are called double and triple stops, which is when a cellist or any string player, for that matter, is able to play two or three strings on the instrument at once. And as long as, generally speaking, with some degree of interpretation, you stay within those chord progressions, it's really a wide range you can do. In some cases, as mentioned with the Bach preludes, when it comes to improvising, it's even neat when you incorporate other melodies from different songs into a particular piece. That works really well with sometimes certain Broadway melodies that you can incorporate into jazz selections.
Do you think genre boundaries matter less to audiences now than they used to?
That is a wonderful question, and something that we strive in our program, and I think this is where the aspect of bridging history and harmony really comes into play, is bringing what some people might consider disparate genres and disparate audiences together. So at least in the cases of our shows, I can't speak on a wide range whether genres might still matter for wide audiences, but what we portray and what we see in our audiences, we're on the road about 200 times a year from the Albany area down to Central Jersey. We found our audiences generally do enjoy when we throw very different genres into the mix, starting with classical pieces, moving into jazz standards, and then into rock and roll classics. And especially when you're able to demonstrate the connections that each of these pieces have, it adds even more value to those what some might consider as very different connections.
That's Alex Prisgentis. He's playing at the Mammakating Library today at 5. It's the Bach to Blues to Jazz performance. They're asking for registration at the library, so you can find that at mammakatinglibrary.org, and of course the library there in Wurtsboro. Alex, thanks for joining us, and have a great show.
Thank you so much for your time.
And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A program reminder, we'll be bringing you the live coverage of Governor Josh Shapiro's budget address to the Pennsylvania legislature today. That's coming up in a few minutes right after Radio Chatskill. But for now, that's all for us right now on the show. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
Today, science is on the threshold of a new era.
On the next Radiolab, we go on a quest to find
the essence of life.
Life.
The key we've been looking for.
Where you'd least expect it.
LSD.
Yeah, let's get the party going.
The Age of Aquaticus on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, a Japanese big band does the mambo. We'll hear new exotic sounds by vibraphonist Carolyn Trowbridge and a band called Sometimes We Only Worry. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, some sun, then turning cloudy, a high of 28. Cloudy with a couple of flurries, not as cold, a low of 11. Later this week, we could see some snow and perhaps some heavy squalls that could impact travel. And then it'll be very cold and windy this weekend. In the meantime, we'll stay in the upper 20s tomorrow with intervals of clouds and sun. Thursday to 24 for the high, and then starting to chill, negative 4 for the low on Thursday. And then by Friday, 22 and some snow up to an inch for Friday.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, physician and healthcare policymaker Zeke Emanuel.
A lot of the wellness gurus out there, they make things way too complicated.
So how does Emanuel see wellness?
It should be something that you actually enjoy.
The wellness industry is gigantic and mostly wrong. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.